ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day. Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist and I've spent the last 18 months deep in the dark world of mis- and disinformation. So what is the difference? Well, disinformation has malicious intent behind it. It's designed specifically to deceive using false information, kind of like propaganda. Whereas misinformation is false information that might be shared by someone who believed it to be true. So who's behind this modern form of propaganda? Find out by streaming The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
Hi, Natasha Mitchell here. Hey, if you're in Victoria over the Anzac Day weekend later this month, why not join me at the wonderful Sorrento Writers Festival on the Mornington Peninsula for four feisty panels of heavyweight thinkers? Just head to the Big Ideas homepage, scroll down, look for Be In Our Audience for more info. According to research just out from the ANU National Security College, 73% of Australians now believe disinformation will pose a serious threat to our national security over the coming decade. Yes, disinformation, misinformation, trolls, deep fakes, false news, they're everywhere and they're already doing real harm to our relationships, our communities, our health, even to the health of our democracy. Because Australia is only one of 29 fully functioning democracies across the world right now. And as you'll hear on Big Ideas today, we can't afford to be complacent. Nearly three quarters of the world's population now lives under autocracies. That's the highest number since the 1980s. My colleague at ABC Radio National, Hamish McDonald, presenter of the Global Roaming podcast, has been roaming the globe to unearth how precarious things are. For his new TV docu-series, it's called The Matter of Facts.
I'm Hamish McDonald, and I'm a journalist, which means facts are my business. I want to understand how technology is changing the way we think.
It really does question your reality.
And why we're all susceptible to mis- and disinformation.
We are just as vulnerable, but we think we're not, and actually that's what makes us more vulnerable.
Do you worry about what happens if we can't agree on facts?
This has been an information war. Facts stop mattering.
This growing sense that anything could be fake at any time.
Looks like you.
That's not me.
The facts are so polar opposite.
Which ones are the facts?
We can't even agree on how to determine what a fact is.
Is distrust creating fracture lines in your community?
I've never seen so much anger and hate in my lifetime.
I was getting an average of 90 hate messages per hour.
Are you scared?
I'm very scared.
Is disinformation really a threat to democracy?
A world where people don't trust anything.
Like, who is that good for?
It's part of the propaganda. It's a biased content production.
The tearing down of democracy began by tearing down facts.
Join me on a journey right around Australia and the world to meet people determined to keep facts alive in this real-time information revolution.
The Matter of Facts with Hamish McDonald. Find it on ABC iView if you're in Australia. Well worth your time. Hamish and I were both part of a media literacy summit hosted by ABC Education with the Australian Media Literacy Alliance. Former Australian Electoral Commissioner Tom Rogers was there. He's very concerned about the threat disinformation poses to Australia's democracy. He advises the ANU National Security College and the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, which produces the annual Global State of Democracy report. Also joining me on Gadigal Country today, Professor Michael Dejuani, Chair of the Australian Media Literacy Alliance. He's from the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child and Queensland University of Technology's Digital Media Research Centre, and former journalist and recent managing director of radio station 2SER in Sydney, Paula Kruger, is now Chief Executive Officer of Media Diversity Australia. And this summit was all about media literacy, which means being able to critically interrogate what we see, what we read here in the mass media, on social media, and really learning how to identify misinformation, disinformation, and other fake stuff when we stumble on it. Let's take it away.
Thanks very much, Lisa.
We're at a media literacy summit here, hosted by ABC Education, but it's interesting, yes, in theory it's great to be a critical consumer of the media, of information, of developing those skills of identifying disinformation and misinformation. But of course that can lead people into a very dark place, can't it? Because you can reach a point where you're critical of everything. You know, this line that's come up a couple of times in the conversations we've had at this event, do you research? That is co-opted by many of the propagators of misinformation and disinformation, where you're encouraged to be sceptical of everything, to trust no one, to don't trust the institutions, don't trust media outlets. Michael, is that a tension here?
Oh, it's absolutely a tension. And we often talk about the relationship between healthy scepticism and cynicism. And we know from our research that too many Australians are cynical about all sources of information, and increasingly people don't trust mainstream news organisations. They're, you know, very cynical about them and think that they're propagators of misinformation, for instance. So our response to this really is that we need a broader form of media literacy education, so that it's not just about being critical. It's not just about, say, fact-checking, or, you know, we hear about terms like pre-bunking, for instance. Pre-bunking is where you teach people to have a critical disposition towards the media, so that whenever they are interacting with, you know, some form of information, they're already predisposed to think critically about it, which, you know, it's a skill that can be useful. But if that's all you're teaching, then you can end up in, you know, these very cynical dispositions for, you know, that people take on.
Well, it makes for very shaky foundations, doesn't it? We've reached a time where there's a loss of trust in expertise, there's a loss of trust in evidence, in science, in mainstream institutions, in the mainstream media. We are on shaky foundations with this, aren't we, Tom Rogers?
I think what Michael said is absolutely accurate. And when I was commissioner, I saw the very worst examples of that. Very sadly, some people have, you know, done their own research. Within an echo chamber, I was bombarded with correspondence from the Sovereign Citizens Movement, amongst others, who deeply believe whatever it is that they believe, and really bonkers stuff, tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy stuff that they deeply believe after having done their own research. Just before I left office, I got one of my favourite letters with an individual demanding that I release information about the involvement of extraterrestrials in Australia's electoral system. And there's a serious, you know, request, and they believe this very deeply, and they wouldn't take no for an answer. So the do your own research stuff, it's really interesting. We need an inquiring mind, but it has to be done in a way where people are open to information, not closed information.
And at the heart of this conversation is trust. Paula Kruger at Media Diversity Australia, trust is a big part of the conversation for you, isn't it?
Trust is the most important thing. It's also the biggest hurdle. When you're dealing with multicultural communities, we've had decades of not being represented well in mainstream media. And so we often talk about the decline in trust in mainstream media, but I think it's fair to say that when it comes to First Nations audiences, multicultural audiences and young people, you never had it in the first place. So it is very hard to point people to trusted sources of information when they don't have that faith in mainstream media. And, you know, you can even look at the coverage today. I'm not sort of plucking out some abstract thing. You know, look at the way politics is being covered today. Race is being presented as a problem. Migrants are being presented as a problem, and it's not necessarily being challenged in the narrative, so in the reporting. And so that's really affecting how people perceive mainstream media. And, like, you know,
so that loss of trust is absolutely foundational.
It's foundational. I'm standing in front of communities every weekend around the country, and I'm talking to them about, you know, what we're going to be talking about with media and media literacy. And, you know, I would be doing them a disservice if I didn't, you know, sit here and say, what are the rest of yous doing? You know, what are you doing about changing the way we tell stories in mainstream media that actually includes other perspectives? Because at the moment, it just feels like it's raining down on marginal, vulnerable communities. But we'd really like, you know, the mainstream media to build some cultural competency. We'll work on the media competency and the media literacy, but we need you to work on your cultural literacy as well.
So let's drill in a bit further, though, in this conversation about what this all means. We're talking about how can people best identify misinformation and disinformation. Why does a lack of representation and a lack of trust in mainstream media make people in culturally diverse communities perhaps more vulnerable at times to misinformation and disinformation? And indeed, I think we need to acknowledge here that they are also often targets of misinformation and disinformation, as you're suggesting.
Yeah, well, so much of the racial commentary that has become a normal part of news at the moment, you know, we sort of think, oh, it's racist debate. It's misinformation. The information is wrong, you know, and yet it is still, you know, it is still out there. It's not being challenged. But when it comes to people being, you know, vulnerable, it's almost, you know, the polarization is something we talk about a lot, you know, with misinformation is pushing us apart and is dividing us. And race is becoming a very strong emotional trigger in order to push people apart. And we're only 2 years away from a federal election, you know. So the big concern with what's happening around race at the moment in public debate, the big concern is it's pushing us further apart. But what's going to happen over the next 2 years?
And I think we also saw during COVID that people would perhaps turn away from the mainstream media and they'd turn towards nefarious sources of information or inaccurate sources of information or overseas YouTube channels, Facebook groups, etc., which can create real physical harm for people.
It can. We kind of encourage people, because we're dealing with multicultural communities who have come here and may still be listening to news from home. I don't think that's a bad thing, so long as it's part of a, you know, to use the salad analogy, a balanced diet of news. So yes, they might be getting information from home. Do they have a trusted source locally? Do they have an independent? Is there one about their community? So encouraging people to ask questions and analyse, you know, their news sources, but have a variety of sources as well, is the healthiest approach for our communities.
Michael Dezuani, you and team have done some incredible surveys across different age groups, so children, primary age, high school age, and also across the adult lifespan, of how equipped people feel, how confident people feel navigating misinformation and disinformation, identifying it, dealing with it. Just give us a sense of some of the findings that have really raised some red flags for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the key findings from our adult media literacy survey work and follow-up work we've done, where we have tested people's ability to actually identify misinformation, is that often people can be overconfident. So people will say that they're able to handle misinformation, but when we test them, we actually find that they can't. And so that does raise a huge red flag, because it suggests that perhaps people won't be disposed to wanting to learn about misinformation if they already feel like they can handle it. We really think that that really points to some of the complexities that we have to deal with when we're thinking about educational interventions. How do you get to people who don't see that they have a problem, for instance? Our answer to that really is that that's why you need lifelong media literacy education. And, you know, people worry about that. We're always looking for a quick fix, I think. You know, it's great if you can say, well, you know, if we can teach people to fact check, for instance, and we can teach them that skill, then, you know, that they'll be okay.
And will they?
Well, no, we know that they won't, because fact checking only works if you have a broader knowledge of the media environment, for instance, you know, how different sources of media function, for instance, how journalism works or is supposed to work, that, you know, the role of journalism in society, all of those kinds of knowledges are not obvious to people necessarily. So we really feel strongly that we need to be teaching students about this from a very young age, and then we need to continue that into adulthood as well.
What are the consequences if people are not able to differentiate between misinformation, you know, identify misinformation and disinformation, or they aren't media literate? What can happen for people's lives?
I mean, it can be devastating because misinformation goes to the heart of learning, of course, but also has consequences for health. It has consequences for your financial literacy. So, in fact, media is so much a part of our everyday lives, and, you know, we get all of our information through various forms of media, including increasingly AI and, you know, social media platforms and so on.
That some people are getting all their information from social media. I mean, that by design, it's a sticky ecosystem that wants to keep you and capture you.
Yeah, well, and we find, though, that people get their information from their families. So they listen to the people who are around them, from their friends, and then from social media, you know, which we would expect. But then that means that they're not necessarily going to other sources of information. They're not going to news reporting, for instance, to hear about what's going on in the world. And they're not necessarily checking, you know, government sources or sources through that are made available through libraries, for instance, as perhaps more trustworthy sources.
Professor Michael DeJuani, Chair of the Australian Media Literacy Alliance, which brings together various universities, the ABC, SBS, the National Film and Sound Archive, and other cultural institutions. Paula Kruger is Chief Executive Officer of Media Diversity Australia. And also joining you, and me, Natasha Mitchell, on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas Today, Tom Rogers, Distinguished Advisor to the ANU National Security College. He served as the Australian Electoral Commissioner for a decade until 2024. Under his lead, the AEC launched the public education campaign Stop and Consider to challenge false and misleading information about elections. Tom Rogers, the state of the nation, the future of democracy, the integrity of our elections, national security. These are all things on your mind in this conversation about disinformation and misinformation. Media literacy is hugely consequential for the future of Australia. Can we afford to be complacent? We have a fantastic electoral system, world class. Can we be complacent?
Absolutely not. And we're very fortunate. I think at the end of 2023, the AEC, the Australian Electoral Commission, was rated as the most trusted federal agency and the one with the highest levels of service satisfaction. And people really love democracy, you know, in Australia, and they love elections, which is fantastic. But it is fragile. It's fragile globally. You mentioned at the start, Natasha, I'm an advisor at the National Security College, and they've just undertaken the most comprehensive survey of Australia's views on national security. You know, 20,000 survey participants, qualitative data there as well, which will be published by the time this goes to air. But interestingly, over 70% of Australians rate mis and disinformation as a threat that we need to deal with. I think, in fact, it's the fourth on the list of 15 things that matches globally. The World Economic Forum has listed mis and disinformation as the second biggest threat over the next couple of years. But interestingly,
so a threat to national security in particular.
Absolutely, because it's about community cohesion and democratic resilience. And interestingly, to pick up on what we've been saying in that survey, I think 60% of Australians are also saying, you know, not only is it a threat, we are either totally unprepared or mostly unprepared for mis and disinformation. And they're actually crying out for a nationally coordinated approach to this and funding, if I might just throw that in as well. So this is an issue for all of us. It's the same thing globally. Mis and disinformation is now being seen as a threat to democracy. You mentioned I'm on the board of International IDEA. This is an issue now that they're taking up as well. So we're not alone in this. Democracy is fragile. As you said at the start, only 29 left, lowest level since the 80s. And this is when we thought democracy had won. was in the ascendancy. So it is fragile and we do need to pay attention to
it. Yeah, yeah. So what have you seen in terms of the threats to election integrity, for example, of misinformation and disinformation, both here in Australia but also overseas?
We had in 2024, it was called the Year of Elections, I think. It was the most elections ever been conducted in one year in history. More people voted than ever before. And we all thought that it was going to be a tsunami of misinformation and AI was going to really play a heavy role. And it didn't. There was some of it, but not as much as we thought.
For now.
Phew. But since then, it's grown and grown. I'll get the dates wrong here, but I think in late last year was the first time we've seen a proper deep fake attack on a Western election. And in the presidential election in Ireland, there was a deep fake video of a candidate who actually subsequently won the election. And it was a really clever mix of video, audio and real footage and fake footage. And the end result was the fake footage was the candidate saying, "I've decided to withdraw." And then they cut to a fake news presenter outside. And the news presenter said, "Well, you know, this is a terrible news, but we've just heard from the Electoral Commission that the election's cancelled." And it was designed to suppress turnout. It was released in that danger zone, the last 48 hours before Election Day, when there's not much you can do about it. And so it's the first time we've seen that. And we're going to see that.
Was it consequential?
Yeah, it was seen by something like about 40 or 50,000 people before they were able to take it down. So those things make a difference.
Well, the taking down of it is vital. That's part of this conversation too, isn't it?
There's a whole story with that.
We'll go there in a tick.
We touch censorship with that as well. But this is an issue in Australia. We've seen the same thing at various elections. Even here when I was commissioner, there were all sorts of mis and disinformation bits and pieces running around. The AEC erases the ballots. You know, it's a classic. One of my favourite was that I was a secret Mason doing the bidding of the World Economic Forum to introduce UN governance into Australia.
Are you? Had to ask.
I can't tell you. So I think we're seeing this has an impact, and just the referendum is where many of these things came out. I was commissioner during the referendum.
The voice referendum.
The voice referendum. Obviously, a strictly neutral and down the middle with everything that we did, and I still am, and I try not to comment on either side of politics. But at that referendum, it unleashed passions that we haven't seen before, and there was a heap of mis and disinformation. And it's the first time that we had to get the AFP involved in my own personal security because of serious threats. So this is an issue for democracies globally, and we do need to take it very seriously.
Mm. What about the national security dimension of this? Can you give us a tangible sense of the way in which misinformation and disinformation can be a national security issue? Because certainly in other parts of the world, and you point to Finland, you point to Thailand. I think earlier today we heard about, what was the place that we heard about earlier this morning?
Estonia.
There are countries that are taking this very seriously because they're on the doorstep of major conflicts. But paint that picture for us.
Finland, they treat media literacy and digital literacy as part of their national security because, again, it's about community cohesion. Not all threats invade across borders on tanks. Some just arrive on phones and invade our minds. Mm. For me, I think the Swedes are doing an amazing job. They've set up a government agency called the Psychological Defence Agency because they take it that seriously as a community that they want to defend what they're doing. And in fact, some of you may have seen the AEC's Stop and Consider campaign, which the AEC runs at every election, I should say, getting about 20% recognition in the community.
So what's that about?
Stop and consider the information before you share it or do something with it. It's been very successful and very cheap, but we shamelessly copied it from the Swedes. They ran a national campaign that I really liked called If It Makes You Angry, It's Probably Fake. I thought that was a great campaign. We market tested that here and it didn't, quite fly. So we did Stop and Consider.
Oh, that's interesting. Love to do a sort of psychological analysis of that.
I'm not quite sure why. But then our campaign then got picked up by others. It got picked up by the Canadians and they ran a version of that and we shared it with others. So I think somewhere here we've got to learn that we are amongst a group of democracies that we can learn from as well. Mm. And we need to look at these global trends and pick them up.
Who runs campaigns and how they're run, though, matters. And it makes me think of that. Does anyone remember that consent campaign that the federal government had its hands all over? Yeah. And it was the most stodgy, boring, embarrassing, unsexy consent campaign. So I think this matters, doesn't it? You're calling for a national media literacy campaign that reaches children, adults, everyone. But who does that? Because if government runs it, then does the public then go, well, what have they got to hide? Why are they running a campaign about misinformation and disinformation? Is this political? You know, it's all very well to tell people not to believe something, but often that makes them want to believe it more. Mm. You know, I hosted an event recently where an audience member said, if someone's cancelled, that makes me more interested in their ideas. Mm. Michael?
I mean, I think the public-facing side of this has to be really well thought through, well-resourced, comprehensive opportunities for people to be thinking about the media and the role it plays in their lives when they're ready to access that. So I think about, for instance, the role of libraries in communities. You know, libraries are this incredible network of resources that we have right around the country. They've always played a crucial role in terms of information integrity. And, you know, they kind of stand ready, if you like, to take up the challenge of misinformation and media literacy more generally, I would say.
Yeah, one of those really powerful third spaces.
Yeah.
Let's discuss social media, the big role of big tech here, because it's basically been able to grow exponentially, unfettered, unregulated to an extent. We've got the under 16 social media ban in Australia. The rest of the world is looking on with interest. I think some of you in your networks are questioning that choice. Perhaps we can come to that. But social media is where the disinformation and misinformation goes ballistic. And as I think you've said, Tom, before, you know, facts have a bad marketing strategy. The truth has a bad marketing strategy. How do you see our response to the social media and big tech providers? Paula Kruger.
Firstly, when it comes, like, I know that social media is the new form of technology that is putting a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there, but I don't know anyone in here who may have had, you know, experience covering politics. What's spin? You know, what's political spin, you know, if not some form of misinformation? So I think we've got, there is some history there.
That's fascinating because it does start at the top sometimes, doesn't it? Mm. You know, we put a lot of focus on the individual to check the facts, to look out for misinformation and disinformation, learn how to identify it. But there's a certain tone to the political discourse in Australia that has seemed to have reached a point that suggests that facts don't matter, that lies don't matter. They don't have consequences. Is that important here?
It is important, but in the context of trying to help people through this maze of misinformation, you know, when you think on a really practical level, what are we asking people to do when they're fact-checking? You know, we're asking you to go through a process of, you know, what's the source, timeliness, when was it done, is it a credible source, are they authoritative? If you're going into a community and you're saying, oh, yes, we've got to teach people how to verify. I used to do that when I was a radio current affairs journalist, and it's hard work, you know, it's a lot of work, and you've got to really dig in there. And yet, you know, we're expecting people in the community to do that. One of the, you know, things that, you know, has been said in FECA's community feedback on actually talking to people about what they want when it comes to media literacy. They're saying, why are we doing the work of a journalist? Why are we talking to them about media literacy in their communities? They've got so many challenges that they're dealing with that we could be giving them support on, and yet we're talking to them about media literacy and when we get their information. So it just feels like layer upon layer upon layer we're adding to the cynicism. We've got to talk to people on the ground and find out what they want to know. They want to know how to protect themselves from scams. Well, you know what? That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to actually listen to what people want and work that into our programs as opposed to coming down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, that's interesting. Michael Desuani, you've suggested that we shouldn't try and combat misinformation. We should learn to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting framing of this. But what does learning to live with it look like? Because, you know, if we think about how Trump's been operating around sowing the seeds of doubt around elections and electoral integrity, for example. I mean, in his case, he's unsubtle, but it can be subtle. Mm. It can just chip away at you
yes.
to the point where you start to go, well, maybe I should doubt the integrity of our elections. We've seen politicians sow the same seeds of doubt around electoral integrity in Australia, which is pretty difficult to contend with. So learning to live with it?
Yeah, so it sounds like giving in, doesn't it? But it's not. We've been talking about combating misinformation probably for at least the last 10 years, and it's been kind of the, you know, the go-to answer. We need to combat, we need to fact-check, we need to pre-bunk, all of these strategies that are intended to provide the skills to be in this battle with misinformation. But what we know from our research is that people are just overwhelmed with information. We're swimming in a sea of information now.
Yeah.
And so the strategy here is not to say that we can hold back the tide of information somehow and that we've got time to fact check every dubious thing that we come up against. We need to provide those skills and abilities and dispositions to live successfully alongside misinformation. I think it's also fair to say that, you know, misinformation predates social media by a long way. You know, we live in a society where the media industries have constantly, in one way or another, tried to persuade us through advertising, for instance. Political campaigning has always been about telling one side of the story, and there have always been efforts to, you know, to mislead people. It's not like this is new. It's just that there's so much more of it now. So the idea here is that you provide people with the knowledge and skills to be successful within that environment.
That's Professor Michael DeJuani's mission as chair of the Australian Media Literacy Alliance. We're considering how to combat misinformation. That's when we share false information without us realising it's fake, without malicious intent. With disinformation, though, the harm is wholly intentional. You're at an ABC Education Media Literacy Summit today with me, Natasha Mitchell, here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Great to have your ears. Also with me from Media Diversity Australia, Paula Kruger, and former Australian Electoral Commissioner and ANU Security College Distinguished Advisor, Tom Rogers.
So let's loop back then to the fire hose that is social media when it comes to misinformation and disinformation. What should be our approach there? Big tech's got away with a lot. They're making a lot of money with getting away with a lot. Mm-hmm. What do we do, Tom Rogers?
Mm. Maybe I might just pick up on one thing I think that Michael said about the fact that this has been with us forever, and I think that's true. I think famously the statistic that people use, or the fact, is that I think in 1675, King Charles II closed down coffee shops in London because he was worried they were spreading misinformation about him. This is not new, but I think there's been three epochs of election delivery in Australia: pre the secret ballot, post the secret ballot, and now the epoch of social media since probably about 2012. And it's turbocharging a range of things that we need to think about and how we need to deal with this. And so this new era, I think of three V words as I was trying to grapple with this when I was commissioner. AI in particular, but social media, is producing information at a volume we've never seen before. This is the different thing.
Mm.
At a velocity we've never seen before, and probably more worryingly, with a veracity we've never seen before. And those three things combined have made a new era from us, and it's very complex. And how we deal with this and how we bring the community with us, it's hard to explain to people what we're talking about. And for me, what I've started to do when I speak to people that are not inside the tent is say, look, everything fits in three categories. It's we're regulating stuff through legislation. And frankly, a lot of that doesn't work. Or we're moderating, and this is the bit where we're going into social media to change things, particularly dangerous things. And the last one is educate, which is the stuff we're talking about here. So it's regulate, moderate, educate. Educate is showing, I think, the strongest results. However we do that, through digital literacy, media literacy, civics literacy, talking to our community. You know, part of that is pre-bunking, and I know that some of the research is still out on pre-bunking, but it's better than debunking because it just doesn't work. So I think these are the things we need to look at as we move forward.
So what about the role of regulation? Is that a game that we've lost, particularly when it comes to big tech?
Well, let me put big tech to one side and I'll come back to it because it's so complex. We've moved from worrying about individual posts and small bits of dis and misinformation to coordinated, inauthentic behaviour, large-scale things that are very complex for us to deal with. And as we've been saying, it's hard for the community to deal with this stuff themselves. They need some assistance. So this is a complex issue, but when you intervene and you take something down, it really causes an issue. We had first-hand experience with this when I was commissioner. There was an absolutely mad conspiracy in 2016 and 19. There was a woman who ran this very, very popular online thing about a vote of no confidence. This sounds mad, but just for one second. She said, if you cross out every candidate on the ballot paper and you write these specific words, no suitable candidate to express my will, it's a valid vote to sack the government, whatever that means. And it was so bonkers that we didn't really worry about it, but it got a lot of traction. So we started to get it taken down because it was misleading people about the vote. But what we found was the more we took it down, the more people said there must be something to it. The only reason they'd be taking that down is if it's true. I saw a large number of ballot papers marked that way. Mm-hmm. And just, I'm no longer commissioner, but just to be clear, it's not true, so don't do it. And also don't draw other things on the ballot paper as well, just while I've got the audience. But we've got to come up with better ways of how we educate people more broadly about the information ecosystem rather than those individual things.
Have you seen it work well in some of those countries you've analysed, and you're working at an international advisory level now? Have you seen convincing examples that work,
yes,
that empower people?
Yes, in Finland, Taiwan, Sweden, and to an extent in Australia with the stuff we're doing. It's world leading with the Stop and Consider campaign and the work the AEC did to be registered as the number one most trusted agency, because everything we're doing is about trust. It's the most critical thing. It's the one true coin of the democratic realm. Everything we're doing is about trusted institutions, trusted agencies and trusted information. So. Mm.
Paula, what's your take on regulation? The heavy hand thereof, but
yeah,
also it's a way that we maintain health and wellbeing in a wider community through all sorts of means,
starting
with seatbelts.
Yeah, it's interesting when we look at the regulation of media, when you look at ACMA, you know, they kind of say, oh, yes, there's regulations, there's rules that the mainstream media organisations have to follow, and you can complain through them. When you're dealing with the social media space, you have a voluntary code. I mean, really, you know. So when we're actually talking to communities about what's happening, and we're trying to give some sort of hope, you know, regulation's not a hope flag I'm waving too highly. We're looking more towards what's happening in the courts, in different international courts, when it comes to who is suing, you know, who is suing social media platforms for harm to children. There's a few going on. Some of them are being settled. But that's where we're looking to go, okay, you know, is it going to go down the big tobacco path? You know, for me, that looks a bit more hopeful than the regulation side of things. But, you know, realistically, you know, it's building resilience in community, and it's telling each other, hey, it's us, you know, we're going to have to look out for each other. When there's misinformation, we're going to need to work through it together, because there just isn't a lot of faith that the structures outside of that, like law case, you know, like legal cases and like regulations, is going to give us the protection we need, and we're really vulnerable.
Michael.
One of the difficulties around regulation is that actually social media has just become so much a part of people's daily lives, right? It's where people go for pretty much everything. It's where they go for social interaction. It's where they go for information, for entertainment.
For breaking news.
For breaking news, absolutely. And so what I worry about with regard to regulation, and this does relate to something like the teen social media ban, is that regulation often is starting from a point of misunderstanding about how social media is used in the first place. So, for instance, we know that a lot of the claims that have been made for the protection of young people, younger teens, and that have led to the social media ban are really just not true, and that actually the vast majority of younger teens who are on social media use it in very productive, joyful ways. They get good information often from social media. When we interview teenagers about what they do on social media, they actually, often surprise us in terms of the kinds of, the quality of information, for instance, that they are accessing.
But that's not to deny that they also go down some very dark rabbit holes.
No, absolutely. But I think the point I'm making is that, regulation has the difficulty of having to solve a particular problem, and it's often difficult to identify what that specific problem is.
Could the under 16 media ban also disempower young people in terms of developing a kind of sense of what is true, what isn't true? They don't have access to the ecosystem, although many still do, that trains them in a sense, that develops that literacy.
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. We know from our research actually that perhaps this sounds contradictory, but the more people use social media, the more critical of it they tend to become, and the more confident that they say they are when they're using social media. So we know that young people learn from each other on social media. We know that they do develop critical dispositions of their own in relation to social media. If you take them off a handful of social media platforms from the age of 13 to 15, the idea that they won't continue to somehow engage with digital media is kind of a nonsense as well, I would say. They're just moving to other platforms. They're using other messaging services and gaming services and so on, right? So this is what I mean about the regulation problem. The idea that you get, as the Prime Minister says, get young people out kicking the footy because they're no longer on social media is just actually not accurate in terms of what the legislation achieves.
Mm. Tom Rogers.
I just, to pick up on the regulation piece, probably the most comprehensive web of legislation at the moment is in the EU with their Digital Services Act. And the European Commission have set up the Democracy Shield, which is related to that. But it's early days. And even there, which is it's probably the most comprehensive legislation web in the world, it's early days to see whether or not that works. And I think for me, if we think through the problems with legislation, laws don't make resilient citizens. Education does and knowledge does. And I think that's why the regulation piece is so complex and difficult.
And yet, Michael, teachers say they really struggle to teach media literacy and how to identify misinformation and disinformation. They lack resources. They're working inside a really crowded curriculum. Yeah. Some schools are very well off and they manage to pull it off. Or often it comes down to a really interested and motivated individual teacher or head teacher. And so that's a foundational issue to get right, isn't it, in Australia?
100%. We're very fortunate in Australia that we have the means to offer media literacy through the curriculum. We have reference to media literacy through the English curriculum, through media arts curriculum and some other areas of the curriculum. And ACARA has been doing a really fantastic job of joining those dots through resources like their Curriculum Connection, which is focused on media consumers and creators. But the missing piece is that teachers don't get the training to really understand how to effectively implement that kind of curriculum. It starts in pre-service education. There are very few universities around the country that actually offer kind of training in media literacy as part of teacher training.
But also the media is so rapidly evolving.
So that's one reason why we within ACARA, the Australian Curriculum and Reporting and Assessment Authority, there's this reference to six key concepts, and this is something that the Australian Media Literacy Alliance promotes as well. Technologies, representations, audiences, institutions, languages, and relationships. The idea with those concepts is that you can teach those concepts as a framework for critical thinking that can be applied to whatever media you then engage with. So you might, for instance, with the representations concept, you're absolutely thinking about racism in the media, misrepresentation, underrepresentation, and so on. And you're thinking about that as much for, say, feature films or television programs as you are for news reporting or AI-generated content. So that does address this idea of rapid change to some extent. Of course, you still need to teach people knowledge about the new media that comes along, but the framework is quite powerful for that reason.
Paula Kruger, we know, though, a whole lot of our learning does not happen in school. Even if we do go to school, we don't do all our learning there.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is really about lifelong learning, isn't it?
You know, and within school structures and everything, that's great. I'm glad that it's with the curriculum. A lot of the people that I'm dealing with, they're volunteers. You know, there is, you know, it's on a Saturday when they work full time and they've driven from a regional town to the capital city where they support, you know, where they're the support for their community in that town, have driven to a capital city and as a volunteer to learn about things and to gain skills that they can take back to their community. So on top of all the other things that they're doing in their community, they're taking on the load of training their community in media literacy as well. Please put some support in these communities so that they can keep doing it.
There's an active conversation about social cohesion in this country right now. How vital is this to that?
Yeah, social cohesion's a tricky word.
It is.
Look, I was just in Logan on Saturday and this, you know, very impressive South Asian woman said, oh, you mean social confusion. But yes, we get the idea behind social cohesion. The frustration with the term is coming from a different place, and that is that usually social cohesion refers to what people of colour need to do for things to be peaceful as opposed to everyone else. You know, it's about us blending in as opposed to genuine social cohesion. But yes, that issue aside, you know...
And perhaps this is also more of a conversation about social isolation.
Yes, yep. And so, but, you know... When it comes to having, you know, one of the important things that we're trying to do when we're talking to communities about media literacy is also describing why we're on the outside of media industry, of all of these conversations that are about us. So explaining, you know, how news values work and how news stories are decided, explaining all of that does help people understand something that they're justifiably angry about. So knowledge and transparency actually, in my view, helps, for the want of a better term, helps with that social cohesion.
And does diversifying who we see on our screens, who we see in our newsrooms, on our radio stations, does that build trust in a way that then in turn combats misinformation and disinformation in the community?
Look, it does. It's one thing to have the representation and, you know, and there have been gains over recent years when it comes to multicultural representation in big media organisations. There's no difference to the power structure. So that affects how we tell stories. So when we're giving hope in communities and talking about representation and representing yourself on your own terms, it's not happening in mainstream media, but it is happening in so many other places. It's happening in community media. It's happening on ethnic media. For goodness sake, look at TikTok. All those people that were listed as, you know, as finalists in the TikTok Awards, huge number of Australians who are people of colour. The winner was a Tongan guy. Amazing. advertising. But, you know, the difference with representation, and the example I like to give, it's just an example with Skid Row Radio, which is a community radio station. And there's a show on there. It's produced by a woman who has experience with a disability. Two of the presenters, one is a Tongan guy who's an ex-rapper and ex-DJ, and you've got a Lebanese guy who is a comedian. They're both legally blind, and they unpack complexities of NDIS. So, you know, this is what happens when you let people make content on their own terms, not fit into the box that you've got, you know, in your strategy of how we do representation. You've got these interesting people talking about complexities of NDIS. One of them's a comedian, so you got jokes in there. He's Lebanese as well. And then, because the other one's a rapper and a DJ, every now and then they drop some really fat jungle beats. You know, it's interesting content. And I feel like that's the thing that mainstream has missed.
Yes.
They've missed the thing that if you let us be us, we are weird, you know. We are interesting. And there's so many different parts of us, but we haven't been let in the door to define ourselves and to have agency to tell our own stories. But digital media, yes, there's all sorts of frightening things with misinformation and disinformation, but the barrier is down and we can represent ourselves as we are.
Brilliant. Yes, less content driven by committees. Let the creatives do what they do best. Final question to you all. What's at stake if we don't address misinformation, disinformation and media literacy in this country successfully? Tom Rogers.
I think back to the trust question. It's a failure of trust in who we are as a people, a failure in trust in our institutions and even in things like election outcomes. You know, elections are, oddly, all about the loser, not the winner. We've got to run elections in this country so that the loser accepts results. Trust is about that and who we are as a people. If we don't get this bit right, it's going to destroy trust, which will really impact on who we are and how we perceive ourselves and how we perceive government.
So it goes to the heart of who we are.
Absolutely.
Michael.
Yeah, I'm going to say quality of life and the danger that if we don't get this right, we continue to just deepen divides that already exist. I think that, you know, disinformation so often plays on those divides and the power structures that we already have and the divisions that might already be there. And so, you know, if we don't get this right, just our overall quality of life, our ability to access high-quality health information, our ability to become better educated, our ability to just creatively express ourselves and to communicate
and
to
make
others,
great choices for ourselves.
And make great choices will all be lessened.
Paula Kruger.
I think I'd finish with power. This is an opportunity to take back some power because that's what misinformation and disinformation does to us. That's what losing trust in something does to us. But, you know, I think there's so much opportunity to boost capacity at the grassroots level and, you know, really just strengthen those muscles in critical thinking. And I just think once we start doing that, yes, it will help us with misinformation. I think there's positives in so many other aspects as well. So, you know, yes, you know, it feels really overwhelming at the moment. It feels like, you know, all of this is happening around us, you know, without any control and it's all getting worse each day. But, you know, there's an opportunity for us to think this through, ask the questions and see where we can actually regain some of the power that we feel like
we've
lost.
I love that point. And also it's about bringing us back to each other, isn't it? Instead of being lost in the cloud of information.
Yeah. The most rebellious thing you can do at the moment is be an ally, you know. So I think that because that's going against the polarisation, bringing people together and backing people, I think that's the most powerful and punk thing we can do right now.
Paula Kruger, Michael Desiani and Tom Rogers, thank you so much for being here at the ABC Education Conference today. Thank you.
Powerful and punk, yes.
A great way to round off this discussion at the 2026 ABC Education Media Literacy Summit. Paula Kruger is Chief Executive Officer of Media Diversity Australia. Professor Michael DeJuani is Chair of the event co-host. That's the Australian Media Literacy Alliance, and hails from the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child and QUT's Digital Media Research Centre. Former Australian Electoral Commissioner Tom Rogers is an advisor to the ANU National Security College and the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. Big thanks today to the head of ABC Education, Annabelle Asprey, and event producer, Grace Ernestine. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Get in touch. Our email, it's easy to remember, bigideas@abc.net.au. Catch you next time.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.